Thank you very much, Mr. Professor. For a while, I wondered who you were talking about, because you can imagine that this person was very old because of all these jobs that I've had in the past, but I started quite early. Let me first of all say that I'll have to excuse myself that I'm going to use this language. Ich habe Deutsch in 6 Jahren gelernt, aber ich habe die meiste vergessen. So I'll speak the global broken English instead of trying to recall what I learned in school many years ago. And this is, I think, a problem that we are facing in the integration of Europe, that at least it goes for Sweden and Swedish conditions, that we don't use the languages that we are taught in school. I mean, I spent 6 hard years striving with the grammar of German. But since we don't hear any German, we don't have any abilities to preserve that. So I'll stick to my broken English. It's a great privilege to address you here at the Humboldt University, and I'd like to thank the Institute for Northern Europe and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung for making this possible. And as a native Swede, I must say that it's a moment of deep trust to talk in the spirit of Dag Hammarskjöld, even though he's mostly and rightly remembered for his strong leadership as Secretary General of the United Nations. You should know that Dag Hammarskjöld spent many years in the Ministry of Finance in the 30s and in the 40s. So he has also played a very important domestic role in Sweden. Today I'll try to share some experiences with you from the period when we had a social democratic government in Sweden between 1994 to 2006. And if you go even further back, you may know that in the early 20th century, Sweden was one of Europe's poorest countries. But in a rapid speed, though, through the 20th century, Sweden was transformed into a modern industrialized society. And there was a silent trilateral agreement contract established between the state, the business society, and the trade unions that made it possible to create what we used to call the Swedish model. Capitalism and high taxes, profitable industries and strong trade unions, flourishing private sector, and a high-quality public sector. And perhaps you may think that Sweden is a bit odd, and I can tell you the bumblebee is flying. It is possible to have these kind of combinations. Sweden is also a bit odd in our relation to the rest of our common continent. In 1994, a referendum took place in Sweden, where the Swedes decided, with a narrow but clear majority, that we should join the European Union. 9 years later, we had a new referendum, and then we decided, in a much clearer outcome, that we should not join the monetary union. I belong to the yes side. I strive very strongly for us to join the Euro club. But I have to confess that it was impossible to convince the Swedes that we should join a club that had been worse off than Sweden, who had stayed outside. That was the primary reason for why we lost that referendum. And now we are staying outside the monetary union. And I said during the election campaign, and I can say it already also today, that the price we are paying for staying outside have two dimensions. One is political and one is economic. The economic price hasn't occurred yet. On the contrary, I would say, having a known interest rate, we can adjust it for only Swedish conditions. But someday, I think that it's vulnerable for a small country to have a single, a known currency, The conditions can change rapidly, and it's better to be in a safe haven as the euro is. So note, the economic price hasn't occurred yet. The political price, though, occurred immediately, and I was the one in the government who saw it more than anyone else, because the very day before I went to Brussels and to meet my fellow colleagues in the ECOFIN Council, the finance ministers, the euro finance ministers met. And of course, that is not a decision-making body. It is the ECOFIN Council who has the formal power. But the relevant discussions took place the day before. And I like to belong to the core cooperation of Europe. So therefore, we are paying a political price of staying outside. Now we have committed ourselves from right to left that we shouldn't make this a question for the electorate until earliest after the next general election, which will take place in 2010. So the euro question is a dead question right now in Sweden. So here we have euro and non-euro countries side by side, even though we are divided by the Baltic Sea. And in my view, this is only one example of the heterogeneousness within the European Union. Although we share common values, there are so many differences between our national welfare state systems that the very notion of a European model or a social Europe are, in my mind, rather dubious. The Belgian economist Andreas Appier, he has helped us to group the European countries, at least the EU 15, before the enlargement of the European Union, into four different policies where you can find different social policies. And he has made an examination to try to answer their relative performance along a number of dimensions. And his conclusion is the following. The first group is the two Anglo-Saxon countries, Ireland and the United Kingdom. They feature relatively high social assistance of the last resort. This model is characterized by a mixture of weak unions, comparatively high disparities in wages, and a relatively high incidence of low pay. That's the Anglo-Saxon model. Then you have the second group, the continental countries. Austria, Belgium, France, Germany, Luxembourg. There are differences here, of course, between the countries, but he has tried to group the similarities together. The continental countries rely extensively on insurance-based benefits and old age pensions. Although union membership is in decline, the union remains quite strong. That is the continental countries. Then we go to the third group, the Mediterranean countries. They concentrate their social spending on old age pensions. The social welfare systems typically draw on employment protection and early retirement provisions. And in the formal sector, the wage structure is covered by collective bargaining and it's highly compressed. And finally, you have the Nordic group. Finland, Sweden, Denmark, you can add Norway, even though Norway is not a member of the European Union, and you can also, in some extent, add the Netherlands. The Nordic group feature the highest level of social protection expenditures and universal welfare provision. And there is extensive fiscal intervention in labor markets, and strong labor unions ensure highly compressed wage structures. And when Saint-Pierre, this Belgian economist, when he analyzed the four different groups, he came to the following conclusion, I quote, "The Mediterranean model, characterized by relatively low levels of employment and high risk of poverty, provides neither equity nor efficiency. With the Anglo-Saxon and continental models, there appears to be a trade-off between equity and efficiency. Only the Nordic model with high employment rates and a low risk of poverty combines both equity and efficiency. End quotation of Sapir. And what I'd like to try now is to elaborate on Sapir's conclusion, to talk about the Nordic model in general and the Swedish model in special. In many people's minds, Sweden has preserved as a model to follow or to reject. There has been strong emotions international in relation to the Swedish model. Some love it, some hate it. But if you go back to 1994, Sweden and the model was undoubtedly in turmoil and therefore questioned as such, also in Sweden. Why? Well, in the early 90s, Sweden experienced its deepest recession since the 30s. To cut a very long story short, in 3 years, public debt doubled, unemployment tripled, and public deficit increased tenfold. In 1994, the general government budget deficit was the largest in the OECD area, 10% of GDP. The reason for this was a collapse in domestic demand due to a real interest rate shock. One important factor was an increase in the household savings ratio by no less than 13 percentage points. Some of the problems in the early 1990s were related to a Swedish habit in the 1980s to devaluate the krona from time to time. We made our products a bit cheaper. And therefore, due to this habit, necessary structural changes were therefore not taken into action in the 1980s, and we paid a price for that in the early 90s. So when the new social democratic government took office in October 1994, the devaluation strategy had failed, and we had to react and act firmly. Only by substantially reducing the deficit could Sweden achieve stability and sustainable growth. We raised taxes. We are very good at that in Sweden. And we cut expenditures. We introduced a reinforced program of active measures of 7.5% of GDP. And after 4 hard years, we managed to get public finances in surplus in 1998. Bear in mind, we had a deficit of 10%. Parallel with the budget consolidation program, we introduced several structural measures, reforms. We got access to the internal European market through joining the European Union. We reformed our pension system, very important, from an unstable pay-as-you-go system to a partially funded system with defined contributions with both private and public parts. We created a new budget process, very good for a finance minister, I can assure you. We set up a system of nominal expenditure ceilings and goals of public finances in surplus. Now we probably have one of the strictest budget processes in the world. And we gave independence to our central bank and set up an inflation targeting regime. What are then the results? Well, high growth. Over the past decade, we have had a higher growth rate than both the EU average and the OECD average. High employment. Over the past 12 years, we have had an employment increase of more than 400,000 people, or roughly 9% of the labor force. The employment rate is the second highest in the European Union after Denmark, approaching 80% of the workforce. Low inflation. Productivity growth in the private sector has gone from 2% per year during the 80s to 3% per year in the 90s. Disposable income has increased substantially, but the high productivity means that the unit labor cost development has been flat between 2002 and 2006, and inflation remains to be very low, below 1.5%. And finally, we have strong public finances. Last year, we had a surplus in public finances of about 3% of GDP. So, What are the explanations for this track record? Are there any competitive advantages that other countries could learn from? Well, that remains to be seen. My personal answer is the following. First, and I say this, as you can imagine, as former finance minister, it has been a significant competitive advantage for Sweden to have strong public finances. It's not only a question of reducing vulnerability for a small open economy, it's also the basis for a well-functioning economy with low inflation and high increases in real wages. The day after I became finance minister, I learned that a long line of people was standing outside my door demanding tax cuts, and very harshly demanding tax cuts. The day after, I discovered a new line, people demanding higher expenditures. And on the third day, to my consternation, I realized that many times the same people were standing in both lines. Here you had car owners demanding safer roads and lower taxation on fuel. Here you had retired people demanding higher pensions and lower taxes. And you can imagine after a week I realized my role in the cabinet to say no. And that's what I did during my years as finance minister. Is this a tough job? Yes, it is a tough job, but it's a necessary job. And in my view, it's a social democratic job. Because for a social democrat that wants a large public sector with generous social safety nets, strong public finances are a prerequisite for the political mission as such. Strong public finances and sustainable surpluses are also a prerequisite for low inflation, a prerequisite for fair distribution. In Sweden in the 50s, we had a blue-collar economist named Gösta Rehn, and he had a slogan that has followed the labor movement in Sweden since then. He said, "You have to learn to hate inflation. We, as the labor movement, are the ones who always will suffer, will lose if we have too high inflation." I'm aware that some claim today that inflation targeting in monetary policy can hinder expansion of domestic consumption. Let me therefore elaborate a bit on this point. Sweden's monetary policy regime, and we have an independent sovereign central bank, forbidden by law to take any instructions from government what to do with the interest rate, similar to what you have in many other countries. Our monetary policy regime has recently been evaluated by two international well-known economists, Professor Franco Giavazzi and Professor Frederick Mischke. And their overall judgment is the following. The Riksbank compares favorably with the best central banks in the world, and that monetary performance has greatly improved from what occurred prior to the adoption of inflation targeting under an independent central bank. As a result, not only the level and the volatility of inflation were significantly reduced, but the volatility of output has also diminished. This has been supported by a country that has had good governance and government policies that have promoted fiscal responsibility, financial stability, and growth in productivity. End quotation. But, and this is a very important but, they also note the following. However, in recent years, the Riksbank has persistently undershot its inflation target. This has been associated with a loss in output and higher unemployment. End quotation. So, here we have a monetary policy regime which is considered to be one of the best in the world, on one hand. On the other hand, they undershot the inflation target. Why did they? Well, some years ago, the Riksbank, like many others in Sweden, underestimated the productivity growth. And the Riksbank have later admitted that their capacity to judge the real economy was too poor. But this doesn't lead either the professors or me that to the conclusion that inflation targeting is wrong as such, but constantly you need to develop the tools for setting the interest rate in line with the inflation target. A prerequisite, though, for inflation targeting is a strong and general commitment to sound fiscal policy and a strong commitment among the social partners on the labor market to have a wage formation in line with the inflation goal. Inflation is primarily decided on the labor market in wage negotiations. And we do have that acceptance in Sweden. The trade unions, they support the monetary policy regime, and they ought to, because the real incomes have increased every year the last decade since we have had the independent central bank. So therefore, in my view, a real social democrat is someone who cares about strong public finances and low inflation protected by an independent central bank, by law forbidden to take any instructions from the government. That is the first competitive advantage, and I think that Sweden and the Nordic countries have been different. We have stick to this strong public finance line. The second competitive advantage is the fact that Sweden is an open economy. We have to be. We're a very small country. We cannot afford to be protectionist like a France or any other bigger countries. And this goes far, far back. And as you know, may know, we have many international companies in Sweden, well-known brands all over the world, like ABB, Ericsson, IKEA, Saab, Scania, and Volvo. Our export as a share of GDP is 51%, and our import as a share of GDP is 42.5%. So we are trading a lot and extremely dependent on the world outside us. Germany is the largest trading partner and has recently outperformed the US. Overall, 56% of total Swedish exports go to the European Union. As a small and open country, Sweden has for long been a strong supporter of free trade. However, we must never take free trade for granted. We know that protectionism is growing. It's growing in Europe, it's growing in US, it's growing in many mature economies. And many people in many countries, they fear higher international competition. In my view, protectionism is not the solution to the obstacles, the negative consequences of globalization. On the contrary, in my view, free trade has been the driving force for the high growth in the world economy during the last two decades. Free trade is a necessary condition for high growth even in the future. It is of great importance that we stand up for free trade. But it's not sufficient only to be free traders. We also need to be fair traders. The enormous gaps between the rich and the poor in the world today put pressure on us in the rich world. Sweden is taking its part of the responsibility by having an official development assistant, foreign aid, of 1% of gross national income. As a small country, we are not part of these big clubs like G7, G8, but I was the only member in the group of one, the only country in the world that had 1% in official aid. I'm very proud of that. And as long as Europe hasn't opened up its markets, and we haven't, ODA expansion is necessary. We need to share both our wealth and our markets with others. Having international competition is one thing. That's good. That's necessary. But you need to do your homework too and open up your own domestic markets as well. The rich world spends about $1 billion per day on agriculture subsidies alone, while the total spending on development aid is less than $300 million per day. Here you find an area for necessary reforms. Talking about markets, the former U.S. Secretary of State Larry Summers, professor at Harvard, once asked what he thought was the main reason why United States has outperformed Europe the last years. And he was only asked to allowed to give one single reason for this. And the answer he gave was not taxes, not the flexible labor market, not the American university, but their well-functioning capital markets. And this is a competitive advantage that we need to realize that they have in the U.S. and we don't have that obvious in Europe. Inflows of global capital not only bring additional funds, but also enrich economy and society through the transfer of new technology and management know-how. By ensuring efficient allocation of capital within the economy, well-functioning capital markets boost economic productivity and long-term growth. Financial globalization has a definitive and obvious efficiency implication. Capital is attracted towards the opportunities of highest returns in the global economy. Faced by the challenge of globalization, the countries that succeed are those that are open and flexible. Rapid technological changes and changes in international competition will inevitably require a constant flow of structural changes. Now we come to the $1,000 billion question. What will happen with the man or the woman on the street in such an environment that we are living in, with these demands of necessary structural changes? Well, they feel as they do, as we feel every day. They will fear change. They will fear globalization. And they will fear China and India. So, how to cope with fear for necessary changes lead me to the third competitive advantage I think Sweden has had, what I would call reliable social bridges. There is no question that companies will close down and people will get unemployed as a result of international competition. The question is how the gains of globalization are distributed in the society. Social bridges is a term that I and Gordon Brown, we published a paper 1.5 years ago where we used this term. It's a term used to describe measures aimed at reducing adjustment costs for employees with economic restructuring causes redundancy and enabling them to seize new opportunities. How to walk on a reliable, stable bridge from old conditions, no longer competitive, to more competitive conditions on the other side of the river. In Sweden, social bridges constitute a policy of protecting workers, not jobs. Protecting workers, not jobs. There are three main types of social bridges in the Swedish context. First, there is lifelong learning. A good education increases people's opportunities of finding work in different companies in a range of industries. This places a major responsibility on regular education, from preschool to university. They must have high quality and be available to everyone. But this is only part of the answer. The other part is to have an educational system that gives people several chances, several opportunities. If you never finished high school in your teens, you should be able to do it in your 20s or in your 30s or even later. Economic opportunities for this must be provided. Let me take one example. During the economic crisis in the 90s, the Swedish government launched a program for unemployed without a degree from secondary school. 100,000 unemployed, remember, in a 9 million country, were given the opportunity to finish their degree with a grant similar to their unemployment benefit. Higher level education at the same time must also be inclusive rather than exclusive. Contrary to many other European countries, everyone with a degree from secondary school can enter university. The choice you made when you were 12 years old will not exclude you from higher education, or rather the choice your mother and father made for you when you were 12. We have also expanded the number of universities and colleges across the country. This has opened up higher education for new groups of students. The group that is growing most rapidly on Swedish universities of today are immigrants, female immigrants. The proportion of female immigrants is growing rapidly due to the new investments in new universities and colleges in Sweden. My belief is that the future for Sweden is to continue to invest in education and research. Sweden has a well-educated population. We're spending a lot of money in all kinds of education, from childcare to primary schools to higher education and research. The total investments in research and development in Sweden amount to almost 4% of GDP, highest in the world. The second kind of social bridge is adjustment insurance. In the event of unemployment, illness, and other forms of social exclusion, people may need financial support. Unemployment insurance, sickness insurance, and other benefits must be designed for people to find new jobs while still providing security. Almost all social benefits in Sweden are linked to your income. This means that if you are not working or prove you are willing to work, you're out of the system. Thanks to our child care system, this policy is the same for single mothers. Or as some put it, we have a workfare system rather than a welfare system. Or put it in yet another way, adjustment insurance should be a bridge to walk on, not a platform to stand on. Constantly, you therefore need to reform the insurance system. The third dimension of the social bridges concept is reintroduction to working life. Many people who are inactive, sick, or unemployed for long term, lose contact with working life and do not maintain the skills needed for working life. To make these people attractive on the regular labor market, it may be necessary to support their re-entry on the labor market by active labor market policies. Unemployed should be given help to find a new job or given the possibility to retrain. We have a large number of programs ranging from on-the-job training to strict school education. An important aspect is to avoid that a culture of unemployment arises. As I said, the idea is to protect people, not jobs. People need to feel that they, as individuals, are reasonably safe, even if increased competition makes the company go bankrupt. By providing social bridges for people to move from old and no longer competitive jobs to new, more competitive ones, we get in return a readiness for change and openness among the general public. I would lie to you if I said that this system means that Swedes love change. They don't, but they accept it. Maybe we accept it a bit better, a bit more than others due to these social bridges. Let me give you one example. Some years ago, I visited a small town in mid-Sweden, a community totally dependent on one industry, a steel factory. You find that kind of municipalities in many places in the Western world. When I came there, I met the local board of the Steel Workers Union, and they had been informed that 100 men had to be fired, and they now prepared themselves for the negotiations with the management. Because in Sweden we have a first-in, last-out principle, and this means that, but with the exception that the unions and the managements can jointly decide who will be accepted from this principle. So they were in negotiating. And I asked the union representative rather naive question, how do you cope with this? I mean, as human beings living in a small town where everyone knows everyone, what you have to do in these negotiations, you have to pinpoint those of your workmates, your neighbors, your sons and daughters, best friends, fathers and mothers, you have to tell them to quit. So how do you manage this? And after a while, they understood my rather naive question, and they answered, you see, the alternative is worse. Unless we don't do this necessary adjustment, the plant might not be competitive anymore. And if so, it may have to close down for good. And in that case, our town will die. And I went back to Stockholm and asked myself, how come the steel workers are so pro-change when it's so painful? They haven't studied macroeconomics at the famous Humboldt University or even at the Stockholm School of Economics. And the answer is very simple. By providing social bridges, you can create a flexible, dynamic society ready to adjust even if it's painful. And this line of argument brings me to the fourth competitive advantage, our culture of collaboration on the labor market. Some years ago, one of our large, international, well-known firms, Electrolux, decided to close down a plant that made vacuum cleaners. The plant had about 400 workers and was located in a small city called Västervik with 22,000 inhabitants. In France, this would have created an outrage. The president of the republic would have called for an all-European globalization fund. He got it, by the way. And there would have been political strikes, and the plant would have been under siege by militant unions. I think you can recall some of this, what happened in your country when Electrolux closed down a plant in Bavaria. In Sweden, what happened there? Well, the blue-collar trade union came out and said, we are against this, of course. Electrolux, they have been here for decades in this small, tiny town. But we have to accept it, not with joy, nor with satisfaction. But still, also this structural change was accepted. And when Ségolène Royal visited Sweden last summer, she asked me, how come we have trade unions that are so prone to accept change, contrary to the fact in France? And I answered her the following. There are two reasons for that. I have already mentioned the social bridges, ensuring that people are not forced to sell their house because they get a fair unemployment benefit, they get training and education so that they can become employable on a growing labor market. That is exactly what happened to the workers at Electrolux in Västervik. They took stock of the active labor market policy, and I don't know how many unemployed there are today, but I think most of them are in work. The second reason why the trade unions are so progressive is the high union participation ratio. Not at least due to the fact that the unemployment beneficiary system is linked to the membership in the trade union. And we have a union participation ratio, people are members of the trade unions, of about 80% among employed people. And that creates strong unions that can bear a large responsibility. Or in other words, when the trade unions try to maximize their members' utility, they have to maximize the whole society's utility. And this creates an environment of responsibility. This creates also a tradition of collaboration, and we do have just as many different interests and opinions and conflicts in Sweden as in any other society. But we realized early, it started back in 1938 when the two major central organizations on the labor side and on the employer side decided to have peace on the labor market. We realized early that Sweden is a little bit too small to have huge conflict on the labor market. And this is extremely important, I think, in an area of globalization. Look at Finland, for instance. Finland is very dependent on paper and pulp industry. They had a conflict in that sector of the economy some years ago, only during 1.5 months. And they had to reduce the GDP for that year by more than 1%. So dependent are the Finnish economy on the paper pulp industry, so dependent are the Finnish economy on peace on the labor market, so dependent is the small vulnerable country that you have progressive, pro-change labor unions. So this all linked together. Our fifth competitive advantage that I like to mention is the gender dimension's impact on the economy. Many European countries face huge demographic challenges. We know our population is aging, and that requires more people to work. Sweden has a high employment rate compared to other European countries. As I mentioned, the second highest in the European Union. I believe our high female participation ratio on the labor market plays an important role for this. And this is not something that just has happened. It's a result of policies designed to help both men and women to combine parenthood with working life. The probably most important decision was made in the 70s when we started to build public child care centers. Today, these centers are open to all children whose parents are working. They have high quality, they are open hours that make full-time work possible for both parents, and the maximum fee is roughly, let's say, I need to transform this into euro, 170 euro per month for full-time childcare. In many other countries, either quality, costs, or opening hours restrict the working possibilities for parents. A second important reform for this gender impact on the economy is has been our parental leave system. In Sweden, parents have the right to stay home with their child for 13 months, 1-3, and receive 80% of their monthly salary up to a ceiling equal to 3,400 euro in benefit from the government during this time. No parent can use more than 11 of these 13 months, which means that the father has to stay at home at least 2 months. Hopefully, this will be will result in a more equal division of responsibilities between the mother and the father as the child grows up. But we have an ongoing debate here in order to have even more incentives or pressure on the fathers to take their responsibility. You may ask, how much does this cost? It is very costly, I can tell you. Roughly around 1% of GDP financed over the tax bill only for the parental leave system. But on the other hand, the system delivers gender equality and therefore high employment ratio. So here you find one example that it is possible to have high taxes. 1% of GDP goes to parental leave system, the most generous one in the world. And it delivers security for the kids and possibility for both the parents to stay home with the kids. And also, it boosts the economy because both sexes are in work. So in my view, equality between women and men ought to be much more discussed in pure economic terms than only as a matter of justice between equal human beings. And I think here the economists have a mission. The last competitive advantage I'd like to mention is the green dimension. Sweden started early with policies aimed at switching to energy conserving and more environmentally friendly method of production, and we are now seeing the results. Despite high growth, and you remember that we have had an average higher growth last decade than both the OECD and the EU area, our emissions of greenhouse gases are actually lower today than in 1990. We regard the green dimension as an important means to create a sustainable society, for obvious reasons, but we also regard it as a driving force for economic growth. The market for green products and green technology is growing rapidly. And in order to support new technology, we did not only support research in new technologies, we also gave generous tax reductions for cars using environmentally friendly fuels, not only lower taxation on the fuel, but also free parking in the inner city of Stockholm and no road tolls. A lot of economic measures used here. Without particularly high cost for the government, we can now see the number of, for instance, biofuel cars exploding. Last year, the number of green cars, so to speak, increased by 7%, by 200%. So there's enormous growth here in the green sector. Yes, I know that climate change is about survival and is about our relation to Mother Earth. But it is also a question of pure economic and competitiveness for countries that like to be in the forefront in the years to come. So you have to look at the two sides of the coin. So, to conclude, openness, education and research, strong public finances, high employment, gender equality, sustainable development, a traditional collaboration on the labor market, and social bridges that make our society pro-change. There you may find some of the explanations why Sweden and the Nordic countries has outperformed average Europe the last decade. Perhaps we are a bit ahead of others in certain areas, but the day you think that your society is perfect, you for sure shouldn't do what I am doing, be in politics. You never have a perfect society. Even though unemployment we think is low by international standards in Sweden, unemployment is far too high according to Swedish standards. Many Swedes are uncertain whether Sweden will be able to compete in the years to come. Parents are asking themselves, like in many other countries, whether their kids will be worse off than themselves. People are worried that low-cost countries and their workers will take their jobs, even in Sweden. But we have to stay competitive. And there is no other way to succeed in the international economy than being competitive. But what is the recipe for competitiveness? Some argue that lowering wage costs, cutting taxes, and reducing social security is the way forward. And obviously the new right-wing government in Sweden, they believe in this. They have therefore introduced a package of lower taxes and reduced unemployment benefits and made other cuts in the public insurance system. And the overall aim is to put pressure on the lowest wages to create a low-skilled, low-wage labor market like in the United States of America. And the other goal is to cut taxes to the average European level. I think this policy mix is dangerous for Sweden's ability to compete in the future. The government policy is not only unjust and creates new dividing lines between people, it creates also uncertainty and insecurity, and therefore less competitiveness. That's my main point. Sweden has outperformed average Europe during the last decade despite, or perhaps thanks to, a large welfare sector financed by high taxes. In my view, the new government's policy will undermine the social bridges and therefore people's willingness to adjust in an uncertain, rapid age. And one of our competitive advantages will be weakened. My firm belief is that globalization makes the case for keeping the Swedish model even stronger. Globalization is not a race to the bottom. It's a race to the top. We need to load every single product, every single service that we'd like to sell abroad with more R&D, with more education, with more design. We had to climb higher and higher up on the ladder. We are not the ones who should compete with low wages and produce the most simple products. That goes not for Sweden, that goes not for Germany, that will not go for Europe either. I think that the Swedish experience shows that those who claim that you cannot combine high growth with a fair distribution of income, they are wrong. On the contrary, the Nordic experiences show that it is possible to combine growth and social justice, even in the era of globalization. I don't think that everything that we have done is duplicable everywhere, but some elements in our model are of universal character, not at least to recognize the very idea of the model. The more people dare to adjust, to move from no longer competitive jobs to new competitive ones, the more competitive the country will be. Therefore, are reliable social bridges a prerequisite for both social justice and economic success? At last, after this Swedish flourish, I can imagine that some of you may consider a relevant question. If everything is so good and so competitive in Sweden, high growth, strong public finances, low inflation and high employment, why on earth lost the Social Democrats government 8 months ago? And maybe the answer was given to me 14 years ago, almost 15 years ago, without understanding it at that time. You see, in 1992, I visited the capital of the state of Arkansas in the United States of America, Little Rock. They had a governor there named Bill Clinton. And I visited their Clinton-Gore campaign headquarters. And I had the privilege, and there are not that many Swedes that have been in the legendary war room where James Carville and Paul Begala and George Stephanopoulos and all the other icons of that age in campaigning sat. And I remember James Carville's famous writing on the wall. He had time for change, something about health care, and then the economy, stupid. Today, I know the hard way that the vice versa is also correct. It's not only about the economy, stupid. Thank you. That's why we lost.